I hope you are suitably refreshed and ready for the coming hour in which Dr. John Wise will present. So John Wise is another speaker who to many of you will need no introduction. He is a very long-term friend and supporter of the Trust in many senses. Of course, he co-authored with Mike the brilliant two-volume bibliography, which does a great service to Green Studies. He edits with Joyce Stavick the biennial journal Graham Green Studies, which we've mentioned already, and the invitation is there again. Please do feel welcome to submit to that. You can find the website online. Enter Graham Green Studies, North Georgia, and you'll find it. Jonathan is also an authority on naval history. So he's a man of many talents. Today he's going to talk on The Virtue of Disloyalty, one of the most vital essays Green wrote for an understanding of his work. And when John suggested this, I snapped him up instantly. I don't think there's been a sustained treatment of it. So John has found a pretty good gap to fill in Graham Greene critical endeavour. So please can I welcome to the front Dr. John Wise.
Oh, thank you very much, Martin. Good morning, everybody. Before I start, Martin just mentioned the Graham Greene studies. One thing I would stress, it is quite costly, this. It is £25. And the reason why it is that expensive is because it is print on demand. However, if you go onto the North Georgia University website, you can read the whole thing or bits of it entirely for free. So you don't have to buy this. You can actually read it for free. And I thought I'd add that. When I was at school, I played the second priest in T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral. Now I can see you're all impressed by that. But one of the opening line, Thomas Becket stands there at the beginning of the play, and the opening line goes something like this: "Dear children of God, my sermon this morning will be a very short one." Well, I can assure you, I'm going to try and keep this as short as possible, because I'm sure you're all greened out by now and just thinking about going home. Graham Greene was at Hamburg University on the 6th of June 1969 to receive the Shakespeare Prize, an award recognising his outstanding achievement in literature. And he gave a speech entitled "The Virtue of Disloyalty," and that's what I'm going to talk about this morning. The Shakespeare Prize dates back to 1937, and it was the invention of a German Anglophile called Alfred Töpfler, and it was an vain attempt to shore up Anglo-German relations during those dark pre-war days. Anyone for Brexit? Green received 25,000 Deutschmarks, a 90-gram gold medal, which is illustrated there, and a year-long scholarship to the University of Hamburg, which he subsequently gave to a student. Top picture shows him receiving his gold medal from the Chancellor of the University, and in the bottom you've got him sitting down there with clutching his gold medal and probably wondering, if I melt this down, how much will I get for it? Apparently, he didn't exactly enjoy the occasion. He wrote to Catherine Wilson later that he found the Germans pompous, the sherry bad, the lunch was interminable, although the Moselle wine was quite good. And to make matters worse, he was suffering from an attack of piles. It's strange thing about piles, that people always laugh when about the quite painful, if you have a painful attack of piles, it's like if you hit the funny bone. There's nothing funny about it. And Mike will like this, that if you get hit in the nether regions with a cricket ball, and you're writhing around on the ground afterwards, everybody just stands there laughing at you. Anyway, there we are. I digress. But it's clear from the opening remarks of Green's speech that the selected audience at Hamburg University weren't going to get a speech which is gently extolling the bard's virtues or revealing the subliminal influences on his own work. So first of all, what I want to do is to summarise quite briefly what Green said in that speech, The Virtue of Disloyalty. Secondly, I want to show that Green did not compose the entire speech entirely for that particular occasion, but in fact reused quite a lot of old ideas, like the good journalist that he was. And thirdly, and most importantly, I want to explore the significance of this speech in terms of Green's writing career. Now, in his first sentence, Green describes Shakespeare as the supreme poet of conservatism, with a small c. He suggests that the reader might even tire of the endings of the great tragedies, where the beauty of the verse, quote, takes away the sting and the last lines heal all, and also revolt against, quote, this bourgeois poet on his way to the house at Stratford and his coat of arms. Ouch. Green then quickly draws attention to the concerns of the present day. Quote, we who live in times just as troubled as his, and lists a number of contemporary protesters who had suffered for their beliefs. Shakespeare, in his opinion, did not merit featuring in that role of honour. He goes on to say, had he sided more with the opposition rather than the establishment, he would then have joined the likes of Zola, Dostoevsky, Dante, and perhaps less obviously, Shakespeare's contemporary, the poet Robert Southwell. Quote, if only Shakespeare had shared his disloyalty, he would have loved him better as a man. Now, the choice of Robert Southwell is curious, unless you remember that at the time, in the 1960s, the Catholic Church was going through the process of canonizing 40 English martyrs, people who died for their faith during the Reformation. And Robert Southwell, poet and priest, was one of those. Green argues that it is the writer's responsibility to take the opposing view, to argue on behalf of those who do not comply with accepted opinions, but those who rebel against authority, and, quote, those who lie outside the boundaries of state approval. He goes further, even challenging the very notion of consistency or loyalty to one particular cause. Green asserts that if the writer can convey to the reader a wider, looser perspective, he then provided a service to society. It is, quote, a genuine duty to be a piece of grit in the state machinery. And that's quite a well-known Green phrase. In his eyes, he ends by claiming that in his eyes, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian who was hanged for his beliefs and for his opposition to Nazi dictatorship, was a greater hero than Shakespeare. So there we have it. Two major strands in the virtue of disloyalty. One, a writer's duty to society, and two, how Shakespeare fails to measure up to Green's expectations. Now, the second part is what was not new. 20 years earlier, Green had been a participant in a rather artificial three-way literary exchange with fellow writers V.S. Pritchett and Elizabeth Bowen. And this was organized by the BBC. The result of that was a series of seven letters which were passed between the three writers. Now, these were collated, edited, and later broadcast in a program entitled The Artist in Society on the BBC's third program. Now, the third program is what later morphed into Radio 3 as it is these days, but it was first broadcast in 1946, and in those days it was deliberately very, very highbrow and dealt with obscure, arty subjects. The rather pompous title of the subsequent published edition of these letters reflects this. Why do I write? Green contributed twice to that exchange. He broached the matter of a writer's disloyalty, and he used that word, disloyalty to the establishment, in his letter to Elizabeth Bowen. He perceived disloyalty as a privilege. By the time of his Hamburg speech, this privilege had become more or less an expectation. Quote, "Isn't it the storyteller's task to act as the devil's advocate?" he demands. Green's reply to V.S. Pritchett's letter uses phrases, even entire passages, which were to reappear 20 years later in the Hamburg speech. He employs the exact phrase, "the virtue of disloyalty," and draws attention to the dangers of becoming over-loyal to and thus constrained by, quote, "some invented ideology of their own." He returned to exactly the same theme in 1962 in an essay entitled "The Writer's Mission in Contemporary Society." This piece was originally intended to be delivered in the form of a speech to the Penn Writers Club meeting in Buenos Aires later that year. In the event, Green failed to attend to deliver the speech, and it was later published in Sur, which means South, the leading Latin American literary magazine, and it's never been published in English. Mark Bosco mentioned in passing Victoria Ocampo yesterday afternoon. And Victoria Ocampo was one of the leading lights of Latin American literary circle at that time, and also a great friend of Graham Greene's. And I think this was a friendship. He didn't have an affair with her, you'll be relieved to hear. But Victoria Ocampo was a good friend of his. In fact, he wrote, after she died, he wrote a little homily to her in which he described her as one of his four best friends. So I think there's quite a lot of investigation worth doing by some scholar who might find out more about the relationship. The reasons, and she was really pressed, she really wanted press to get him to come over to Buenos Aires and give the talk. And I've read some. There's sort of four letters which Green wrote to her in that year, and he said, "Yes, I'm coming. Yes, I'm coming. Yes, I'm coming. No, no, I'm not coming." And of course, he gives the usual excuses about pressure of work and so on. I think the reason behind this is that he did attend a Penn Writers meeting a few years earlier in Brasilia, and he hated it. He found it dreadful, and there was one particular Latin American professor who he took a particular dislike to. And in fact, he's written about that in an unpublished short story called Mr. Conway's Congress. And I hope one day that will be published. And it's all about writers meeting, all meeting together, and how sort of dreadful it is. anyway, on the occasion writers in that particular essay, which was later published, he states that it is the duty of the writer to be disloyal to the state. He quotes from Robert Browning's Bishop Blougram's Apology, which he used several times, to show how, as a writer, he must have the freedom to argue from the opposing viewpoint. Quote, doubt and even negation must have the opportunity to be expressed. This notion was expressed more succinctly in Hamburg, where he claims that the writers should have the license, quote, to roam through any human mind. It's harder, but it's not impossible to find examples of Green's negative views on Shakespeare prior to 1969. He reviewed three films of Shakespeare's plays for the Spectator in the 1930s, including the Hollywood version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which has an interesting cast. There was James Cagney as Bottom. There was Mickey Rooney, aged 15, as Puck. He looks about 9 in that. And Olivia de Havilland as Hermia. In his review, he confessed to having, quote, little affection for the play because, quote, it seems to me to have been written with a grim determination on Shakespeare's part to earn for once a universal certificate. The implication that the playwright's mercenary aims took precedence finds echoes in The Virtue of Disloyalty in Green's comments about the bourgeois poet wanting his house in Stratford and his coat of arms. Now, I'm going to risk being lynched when I say that I think that Green there is guilty of dual standards. Here's a man who's always going on about his terrible childhood and how that had influenced his entire career and life. And yet, at the same time, if you have a thought for William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare, if you think about his childhood, his father was this who made gloves, but was also a bit of a wheeler dealer and constantly got into trouble over money and was in fact sent to sent to prison for not paying his debts. It's little wonder that Shakespeare wanted financial security when he was an adult, and that would have been a little defense there of Shakespeare. In his wartime, Green wrote a little wartime book called British Dramatists. He wrote this on his trip out to voyage out to West Africa during the war. And in British Dramatists, Green claims that Shakespeare's contemporary John Webster's ability to express in words the symptoms of mental illness exceeded that of Shakespeare's. Shakespeare's emotional detachment, he suggests, adversely affects the quality of his writing. Quote, that enormous genius must be allowed his limitations. Even in his darkest period, he was too sane, too conscious of his art to express madness convincingly. But the most overt criticism of Shakespeare's skill in presenting the full range and depth of human emotion appears in Green's introduction to the autobiography of an Elizabethan, published in 1951. The autobiography concerns John Gerard. Now, John Gerard was a Jesuit priest who came to Britain and was arrested and tortured in the Tower of London before managing to escape and later write his memoir. The memoir was written in Latin, and that was translated by Father Philip Caraman, who was a good friend of Green's at the time. And Caraman managed to find evidence that among Gerard's torturers was the philosopher and all-round superbrain Francis Bacon. In his introduction, which Green wrote to that book, Green invites the reader to indulge in a flight of fancy and to place Shakespeare in the role of Gerard's persecutor. Quote, "If Shakespeare had sat where Bacon had sat and given the orders for the torture, one wonders whether into the great plays which present on the inner side, however much on the outer Lear may rave or Antony lust, so smooth and ambiguous a surface, there would have crept a more profound doubt than Hamlet's, a sense of love deeper than Romeo's." Green even borrowed the title, The Virtue of Disloyalty. It was used in the 1930s by Mahatma Gandhi to advocate passive resistance on the part of Indians seeking home rule for their country. Gandhi, in turn, had borrowed the concept from the American 19th century abolitionist Henry Thoreau in his essay Civil Disobedience, and he'd argue where Thoreau had argued in favor of protest and resistance in order to attain a more just form of government. This brings me to the third part of my talk. What is the significance of this speech? Why did Graham Greene choose this particular occasion to make what was a deliberately provocative speech? He leaves clues in a short preface, which typically perhaps for Greene was intended only to be read by a limited audience. Now, although the text of The Virtue of Disloyalty was published twice in 1973 in John Stafford's book, and again in 1990 in Reflections, which is introduced by Judith Adams, and it's a shame she's not here today, but it's a very good collection of Green's work, his essays and so on. But in neither of those publications, it carries the preface. And I've asked Judith Adams, who worked closely with Green on the production of Reflections, and said to her, I showed her the preface and I said, have you seen this before? And she said, no. And it wasn't discussed. So clearly it wasn't an issue that the preface should be included. And the preface appeared in book form only in a limited edition of 300 copies, which was published in 1972. And that edition he gave, as he often did, he gave as a Christmas present to friends and family. So a very, very limited readership. But, and it's the only reason, quite honestly, it's the only reason why I have got to know that there was a preface, it did appear in the Observer newspaper in December 1972 alongside the text of his speech. And that's how I know of its existence. And so the moral of that is never throw anything away. In the preface, Green relates how the theme of disloyalty had been an obsession since youth and how it had appeared, quote, like a tiresome and persistent weed in many of his novels. He admitted that he did not understand why he had been awarded the Shakespeare Prize in the first place, but felt that his theme was a suitable subject for a German audience composed mainly of students who were not born when Hitler was alive and older professors whose, with memories of the Nazi regime, who might well be disquieted by references to divided loyalties. In the final paragraph, and it's very, very short, in the final paragraph, he makes it clear that his admiration of Shakespeare was qualified. He then adds, rather contradictorily, typical of Green, that his whole speech, quote, should be taken with a grain of salt, and that it, quote, masks a different offensive. So what was that different offensive? It's tempting, I think, to single out a specific incident. Previous year, Spy Kim Philby's autobiography, My Silent War, had been published. Green had written a very controversial foreword, siding with a notorious traitor to his country. In places, his admiration bordered on adulation. He praises Philby's leadership, his loyalty to those who work for him, his wit, his skill, and his intelligence. And above all, he admired Philby for his unwavering devotion to the communist cause, even though that meant betraying his fellow countrymen and being responsible for the deaths of an unknown number of people. But surely, though, Green's Hamburg speech had a wider focus than simply a defence of his views on Kim Philby. Interestingly, Green's remark in his preface that his speech, quote, disquieted the professors, but I think pleased the students, was entirely prescient. This was, after all, 1969, the year after the great student protests in the United States, London, Paris, Berlin, and so on, and Green had caught the mood of the moment. Topical references within the speech to modern-day martyrs, such as Pasternak, Sinyaevsky, and Solzhenitsyn, imply that the different offensive was indeed a political one. Neil Sinyard has suggested that during this later stage of his career, politics, quote, displaced religion at the forefront of his fiction. Professor Michael Brennan, in his book about the politics of Graham Greene, makes a similar point but goes further, quote, as he grew older, he depended ever more heavily upon diaries, notes, and journalism to breathe life into his fictional creations. Indeed, it is now often his adoption of an overtly political perspective that most readily endows his fictional writings with a clear sense of narrative progression. As his skills in formulating gripping storylines or entertainments waned with age, so Green's utilization of global issues and political causes became more central to his creative purpose. But I think it would be unwise to assume that Green's writing experienced a sudden sea change. Rather, that we can detect an increasing trend, a kind of overlay in his fiction and in his other writings towards involvement in politics, and this preoccupation becomes more evident towards the end of his life. His intended speech for the Penn meeting, the Writers' Mission and Contemporary Society, which described earlier, might be considered an early example of that growing commitment. But much of his fiction, from the mid-60s onwards, The Comedians, 1966, Travels of My Aunt, 1969, The Honorary Consul, 1973, Human Factor, 1978, and The Captain and the Enemy, 1988, all carry strong political themes. Even his memoir, which is a non-fiction, Getting to Know the General, about his relationship with Torrijos, was originally intended to be a novel, but it never got off the ground, and it ended up in its form, which was published in 1980, which was a description of his relationship with that man. But it could well have been ended up as fiction, but obviously with a very, very strong political overtone. Also, Green became increasingly active and indeed strident on political causes in the form of articles, speeches, letters to the newspaper, a trend which was to continue for the rest of his life. Prominent examples close in date to the Hamburg speech include Authors Take Sides on Vietnam, which was published in 1967, Viva Chi, oh, sorry. Perhaps it isn't there. Viva Che, contributions in tribute to Ernesto Che Guevara in 1968, and A Happy New Year, remarks by Green at the Penn Writers' Meeting concerning the imprisoned writers Siniavsky and Daniel, 1968, and also his introduction to Bernard Dietrich's book, Papa Doc, Haiti and Its Dictator. In addition to that, Green had published in leading British newspapers and magazines between 1967 and his death in 1991, no fewer than 40 letters with a political theme, principally highlighting injustices of various kind. And if you look in the archives, you'll find, particularly on the subject of Nicaragua, Green wrote countless other letters on that subject. There were so many that in the end the newspaper editors got tired of it and they didn't publish them, and Green sort of recognised that. This I think is the different offensive which Green refers to in his preface of The Virtue of Disloyalty. But what had caused this shift in direction, which brought politics and protest more to the forefront of his writing? Essentially, in this area, one can only speculate, I think. I think we have to turn to the beginning of the decade, beginning of the 1960s, and perhaps before, for answers. During the early part of the 1960s, he seems to have experienced a personal watershed in his life. In 1961, a burnt-out case was published. He found that the process of writing that book particularly exhausting, and he was clearly in a mess psychologically for all sorts of reasons, including his private life, as Professor Michael Mavis has revealed in his brilliant and forensic analysis of Green's journal that Green kept at that time, which he talked about last year. Later, Green stated in his autobiography, and he did so elsewhere, that he was convinced at the time that A Burnt-Out Case would be his last novel. He turned into the theatre instead, where he had found solace before, and he wrote Carving a Statue. But that play was an unmitigated disaster. He then fled to the south of France, where alone in a rented apartment, he began a journal called The Last Decade, which he would use as an aide memoir for what he expected to be his last book. This was 1964. And the journal narrative starts portentously, quote, "I begin my last book a few hours before my 60th birthday," and it continues in the same vein, rather morbid meditation on approaching death, punctuated by worries about his health, descriptions of various terminal illnesses suffered by his contemporaries, his increasing dependency on alcohol, and his problems when trying to write. Quote, "Work again has reached a point of near despair." That's when he was trying to write The Comedians. However, this depressive phase proved to be temporary. An edited, and I have to say sadly sanitized, version of The Last Decade was published 20 years later, and Green was able to recall in the preamble, quote, "The last decade, in fact, proved to be one of the happiest of my life, and saw the publication of books not among my worst, The Comedians, May We Borrow Your Husband, Travels My Aunt." I think his increasingly settled relationship with Yvonne Cloetta, his successful move to France, the ending of his role as the sort of unofficial spokesman for troubled Catholics, which happened particularly after the Heart of the Matter, and was brought to the end by the seemingly personal statements about loss of faith in a burnt-out case, seemingly, I say, might have been contributed to his being able to clear his mind of some of the personal problems he had been beset with, and to be able to use his skills as a writer to address particular causes more overtly and honestly. The duty of the writer, he had, of course, publicly proclaimed on more than one occasion, as I have shown. Not that the writing process itself became any easier. The human factor, for example, took 12 years between starting and publication. And Mike Hill has found manuscript proof that Green must have commenced writing The Captain and the Enemy probably in late 1975, and of course it wasn't published until 1988. To conclude, there's an unmistakable tone of confidence about the virtue of disloyalty, in addition to a very Greenian measure of mischievousness, where he reminds us in his preface that what he had to say should be taken with a grain of salt. And it also appears that he rather enjoyed making the older Germans in the audience feel uncomfortable on their home turf. His outlook on life had clearly changed. Speculating on what he thought was impending death in the last decade, in 1964, he wrote, "The end of life faces us like a wall, and every day we must take a step towards it." 5 years later, in Travels My Aunt, he uses the exact same image, but there is a marked difference. Aunt Augusta says, "My dear Henry, if you live with us, you won't be edging day by day across to any last wall. The wall will find you of its own accord without your help. And every day you live will seem to you a kind of victory." And you could also take that idea of the wall as being a metaphor for his inability, or seeming inability, to write any more and to write any more novels. When Green received this prize for outstanding achievement in the field of literature in 1969, he had the audacity, but more significantly, the renewed commitment to the power of the spoken and written word to turn what might have been an easy exercise in bardolatry into a platform for vigorous and topical political debate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John, for a thoughtful, again, very methodical talk, which puts into context one of Green's great essays what came across so well is how Green sought to ground his own work and, in a sense, sought to ground himself in his writing and frame it and put it into context in such a way that it can come across to us in a way that describes the course of his fiction and its development. Has anyone got questions for John, please? Anyone in the audience? Yes,
Claire. Thank you for that, John. My thesis was entitled The Virtue of Disloyalty.
Oh, was it? I should have consulted you first.
I agree with you on his motivation. I think had the University of Hamburg given a Milton Prize, found some reason I think he really was waiting for those smug faces to fall a bit and be a little bit uneasy about what they'd done in the 30s and up to 45.
Yes.
Wondered whether they had perhaps not been disloyal enough to the state.
Indeed.
So
yeah.
I agree. I think it was utterly, in widest sense, a political intention.
I agree with you.
Shakespeare.
I agree. It could have been anyone.
Or in the machinery of that.
Yes, it was typical of Green to surprise the audience and so on by taking the opposing view.
What happened to the 8 grams of gold?
I don't. Well, I think I'm not sure. Perhaps Mike will remember that a lot of the Green, well, you call it loosely memorabilia, but the awards that he got, and he got a lot of awards in various places, mainly in other countries. It had to say they're at Boston, aren't they, Mike? And but I can't remember seeing the Shakespeare Prize there.
Was it one of
the Centenary Festival? You have it. Oh, I wish I knew that. You could have brought it along, Caroline. And we could have seen it. Yeah. And it does it. Is it sort of? It's gold. It's not that.
It's not bronze.
No. Oh right. It's not gold. It's not. It's not gold. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was wondering, where does this obsession with disloyalty come from?
I think it dates back to his childhood. I think it's another aspect of what he wrote about a great deal, was this divided, what he described in another in other writings of his divided loyalty, which was accentuated when he was in this place, and where he spent half his life at this side of the building or the other side of, and then there was the public exposure to the pupils and so on, which he, as a very sensitive boy, was a great problem for him growing up. I mean, I think it's something which perhaps other youngsters wouldn't really have perhaps noticed, but being the sort of lad he was, those things became very important to him. And you know what kids are like. They can, you know, they're very cruel sometimes to one another. And I think the divided loyalties and the sort of accent on disloyalty would have started. But it was, as I showed, I mean, it was something which he had in his mind for a long time. But obviously the ideas began to sort of formulate during that time, and before that speech in Hamburg.
Just ask a sort of fairly peripheral thing to what you said, John. It's always struck me as slightly strange that he actually bothered to turn up and make the speech anyway. It's not a very Green-like thing to do. You say he didn't actually make very many public speeches.
No,
and
no.
Just occasionally, one year, I think, was it when he was in Moscow? He sort of stood up and was almost sat down before somebody could make a record.
Here he
actually did physically stand up and deliver
yes,
the speech
yes,
in,
yes.
in front of all these august
yes,
people.
Yes, yes.
It just struck me that that motif that, for example, it comes into the third man, and he got it from Buck, of course, that thing where somebody is preparing to give a speech, and they're disconcerted and so on. It's all, you know, all the pressure of being expected to give a speech, and in Holly's case, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And anyway, the baddies are after him, and so on. So it's almost as if he might have been almost tempting himself to be in that situation. You know, he does
put myself on the spot.
On the spot. I don't want to praise Shakespeare. There's going to be a whole range of people in, you know, the great and the good expecting me to.
Yeah. So I'll be the contrarian. Yeah. I'll turn up and down while I do it.
Yeah, I think the other thing, I think it underlines the importance of that speech, and that, you know, that he wanted to deliver it, and he wanted to deliver it at that time, and it linking in with the fact that, you know, we were in the, it was in the world of student protest, and I can't think of any speech, record of any Green speech, he was anywhere near as long as that, and as detailed and thought through, and the very fact that he allowed, he could have, you know, as Robin Lustig said yesterday, news, you know, it's new, something which is all news today is forgotten tomorrow, and it could have just disappeared. It could have been, I mean, it was published first, at the university, that's the sort of official brochure, and the Green speeches in there in German and in English, and it could have been left at that. He could have left it at that, but 4 years later, it was included in Stafford's book, and then and then right at the end of his life, it was included in Reflections. That surely shows that Green considered it important, and he considered it to be of important and of lasting importance as well. But I just think it's a shame that he didn't include that little preface. Because that explains it. It says, yeah, well, yes, I said that to stir people up. But also, it was masking a different offensive. And why not say, you know, why include that so people could realise that he not only made this speech and giving his thoughts on Shakespeare, and also say, well, I'm making a political point as well. I didn't even have to elaborate on it because people, idiots like me, could work out what he meant.
Yes, John.
Well, did it in fact stir a lot of criticism in the press or in academic circles that he would make a speech critical of Shakespeare?
Well, I haven't seen any evidence that people were up in arms about about his views on Shakespeare. I guess when it appeared in the Observer, there may have been people writing saying, "How dare Graham Greene criticise Shakespeare?" That was the 60s and 70s was the age of bardolatry. You know, where Shakespeare was, it was other poets, you know, poets, playwrights, and so on, and Shakespeare. And Shakespeare was the, I can remember at school, you know, you studied the lines by Shakespeare, and you weren't seeing Shakespeare in the context of his time. You weren't seeing Shakespeare as somebody who was a jobbing actor and writer. There was no context. It was just the verse, just understanding the verse and the beauty of the lines and so on. So it may well have stirred up people, you know, people's opinions in newspapers.
Yes, Nora.
So after the speech,
yes,
and after Green's, you know, getting involved with all this political stuff,
yeah,
all his worries about losing his writing talents and abilities, do you think that Green has a late style as a writer?
I don't necessarily think that he changed his style of writing. I think that the political concerns, which were, you know, he always, well, doesn't always, but going right back to the 1930s. A novel like It's a Battlefield, it's quite political, that book, in some senses, but I think it...
I'm not sure if I remember correctly. He did say it in one of his radio interviews as his works is political, even starting from the first novel intended to write.
Yes.
And lasting for all his writing
career. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. But I think what distinguishes his later novels is that one can identify he's making serious political points, which perhaps in the earlier novels you might have just seen that as peripheral, because the main thrust of it was towards was more about the inner man, about man's consciousness, and rather than about religion, rather than overtly political. If you take a novel like Travels My Aunt, which appears to be everybody, you know, it's commonly said, well, Green himself said it was written in his manic period, where he was uplifted and quite positive. Nevertheless, that is a serious novel, and in fact, when it first appeared or was about to be published in America by Viking Press, the blurbs and the advertisements for it presented it as a farce, and Green was furious about that, and said, "This is a serious book." On the basis of that, he in fact left Viking and went to another publisher, American publisher, for that reason. And if you read the last part of it, particularly, that is very political. It has a lot to say about the American influence in South America, and so I think that is an example of that. By that time, his preoccupations were very much geared towards political issues, and of course, well into the 70s and 80s, it becomes more overt, particularly his commitment to Latin America, as Mark Bosco talked about yesterday.
I have a question. I wonder if I can. Just one more.
Well, you let me off the hook, Martin.
Half-hour mark. I'm struck when I read the essay that Green is, in a sense, giving away the secrets to his craft.
Mm-hmm.
So, on the face of it, the idea that we sympathise with the victims, and of course the victims change, which means when sympathies change, seems commonsensical in many ways, and yet it is the secret to so much of Green's imaginative flourishing right across his career.
Mm.
And to draw a loose parallel to say what I'd like to ask, the great African-American novelist Toni Morrison, the Nobel Prize winning amazing writer, is often asked to write an autobiography or a memoir, and she refuses because she'd like to write another novel. You know, she wants to voice the experience that she represents so well across her writing. And I wondered, obviously, she wishes to hold dear some of what drives her writing, and I'm surprised Green gives so much away. And I just wondered whether there is something to that, whether that maybe is an oversight on his part. Did he need to write the speech, really? Would his fiction have been better without it? Would we be wondering a little more without it? Obviously, these are all speculative questions, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in sort of thought of that. I don't know. Does he give away anything that is new and special by saying that?
Well,
I mean, to say that you're the duty of the writer, the writer has a sort of social responsibility, is, I don't think that was a unique thought on his part. I mean, even in fact, if you sort of look more closely at those letters, the exchange of letters, the others agree with what Green say, and said, and in some cases they kind of slightly expand on it. I think, you know, the writer as a and the social duty of the writer was not new. I mean, if you look at a lot of Russian literature, you will find that is there. He's okay. He articulates it, but I don't think he's giving away any.
No. To be a piece of grit in the state machine,
yes,
I would think would be to some sort of fodder for their own yeah. attack of him sometimes. But
yeah.
I guess he is simply being open.
Yes, and that piece of grit quotation is typical of Green, isn't it? I mean, yes. that typical of that speech, yes. that he's contradictory, typical that he presents us with an opposing view that we wouldn't necessarily otherwise have thought of.
Very good. Thank you. Mm. Okay, well, I think you've provoked a wonderful discussion to take us to the end of the programme. So please, can you give a round of applause?